If you pay attention to the Christmas advertising, you'll see a few ads trying to convince people to buy drones for their loved ones, the little drones that fit on a tabletop, not the big ones that circle at thousands of feet and take out terrorists. Those are the military drones. But there's plenty of reason to think that the military makes use of the smaller drones, too, and Oregon State University is involved in research into that kind of drone use. Drone swarms, in fact, using many small vehicles at once in the air and on the ground. To help us unpack this is the professor closely involved. Dr. Julie Adams is a computer science professor at Oregon State University, working out of CHORUS, Collaborative Robotics and Intelligent Systems. Dr. Adams, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you.
Let's start with the drone work already underway at CHORUS. It sounds like it's been going on for a while and is fairly extensive.
So do you mean the drone swarms or drones in general?
Because drones in general.
Drones. Okay. Yeah. So drone research in general has been going on for many, many years, probably more than two decades. But more recently, of course, with the advent of the iPhone, we started having technologies that would facilitate the smaller vehicles that you just referenced that people are purchasing for children on Christmas. And that has brought a whole new level of possibilities for this kind of technology. So that type of research has, you know, picked up over the last decade, and, you know, we continue to be able to put more and more capabilities, just like we do into our smartphones, into these smaller and smaller vehicles that, you know, now allow us to do some different things than we could do before.
So it stands to reason that the march of technology, as fast as it comes to the phones, it's going to come to the other stuff, too.
Yes, that's right. In fact, there are a lot of people in the robotics community who really attribute many of the advances that you've seen and the reason that you see robots on TV in commercials and such as much as you do is because of the technologies that were developed for the smartphones that facilitated all the development of smaller capabilities that are usable in robotics.
Which, when you think about it, is a bit of a reversal from the way things used to be. I remember hearing that a lot of good consumer technology came out of the ending of the moon missions, where the space program began to downsize just a bit. So it was driven by some larger scale military industrial kind of technology, but now it's driven by the consumer technology.
Well, that's true to a certain extent. I mean, it's definitely the consumer technology is driving the development of smaller sensors, for example, and things like Echo are, you know, giving some advances to things like natural language processing. However, you also have to keep in mind that a lot of the areas in which the consumer technology is used is a very clean environment. And so at the same time, we still have a lot of advanced research and a lot of advanced capabilities coming out of federally government-funded funding, not just for the DOD, but the National Science Foundation and various other agencies.
When you say clean environment, as in not the dirty and gritty and people having things explode around them like in
that, or just, you know, our natural outdoor environments. Mm-hmm. So things like, you know, today, at least in Corvallis, it is raining. You know, we've had a lot of nice sunny days for the last couple of weeks. So things like simple weather changes. You know, a day like today is not a very easy day to even attempt to fly very small drones. However, a lot of the days that we've had recently would be perfect. So, you know, there's things like noise, traffic noise, you know, things of that nature. When you're in a city, there's a lot more noises from buildings being built and people talking and traffic and aircraft, you know, taking off at airports and things of that nature. So there's a lot of ambient noise that makes something like, you know, Echo not work very well in those kinds of environments. So you're able to, in a clean environment, a man-made environment such as a home, you are able to put sensors in that environment, and you've got certain characteristics of that environment, such as the acoustics, that allow for the technology to work pretty reliably, although we have seen some nice fails of these kinds of technologies on YouTube. And so once you start talking about trying to take these same technologies out into a noisier, less clean environment, meaning that it's not as easy to sense things, then it becomes a much more difficult problem to get things correct.
Dr. Julie Adams at Oregon State University is talking to us about robotics and drone swarm technology. She's working on a project for the military now. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when we talk about drone swarms, are we just talking about trying to get around some of the things that are in the less clean environments, where situations where you could lose a drone or and still be able to continue doing what you're doing?
Yes. So, you know, to a certain extent, this isn't just for unmanned aerial systems. This mm-hmm. is true also for other types of robots, right? Be they ground or be they marine. You know, and we're a state, Oregon is a state, and even California, that does a lot of marine robotics as well. So, you know, being able to handle all these different environments becomes very complex very quickly.
Mm-hmm. So what specifically, what kind of applications is the military looking for with drone swarms?
So for purposes of the project that, one of the projects I'm working on, we are looking to be able to keep our military personnel safe in these large urban environments, being able to use these kinds of systems to do things like getting information about what's happening in these in dangerous environments, trying to understand where our adversaries may be hiding and trying to flush them out, you know, things of that nature that you'd rather keep your human personnel safe and away from, and make it easier for the human personnel to come in and take care of the things that they actually need to take care of that we don't want the robots to take care of.
So potentially a drone sweep before the humans get in, or
yeah.
Or yeah, okay.
Yeah. Or out, you know, out ahead of them. So if you think back to, you know, some of the various movies you've seen or things that you saw on TV during the various wars over the last 15 years, you know, you often have some advanced team that goes out in front of, say, the team that's transporting goods to the next base in order to look for dangerous situations. Now, in the Middle East, that was looking for IEDs, for example. In an urban environment, there are a lot more places for various things to be hidden that could negatively impact our soldiers' abilities to do the things that they need to do. And so you'd like to be able to safely send out both ground and aerial robots or drones to look for those things and identify where they are before the humans are affected by them.
Is there any sort of set of benchmarks you're working with, Dr. Adams, like, you know, five drones per person or one drone per person or approximately
that?
What the ideas for deployment are?
Yes. Yeah, so those kind of benchmarks that you're talking about don't actually exist at this point. Mm-hmm. This technology, especially for swarms, and in this context, I'm really talking about swarms, not individual vehicles. You know, when you're talking about swarms, this kind of benchmark just simply doesn't exist yet. It has been very difficult to be able to deploy large numbers of vehicles. So Tim Chung, who is the program manager for one of the projects I'm working on from DARPA, when he was at the Naval Postgraduate School, he actually deployed 50 fixed-wing UAVs. And that was a record at the time. More recently, over the summer, the Chinese deployed 119 fixed-wing UAVs. It takes a lot of time and effort and personnel to deploy these systems and then also to maintain them in the air, if you will. And then, of course, you've got the battery life issues. So, you know, if you have your own UAV at home, you know the battery doesn't last very long. And there's no magic battery power for the military. It's the same battery.
So you're stuck with the same stuff we have.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the same battery. In fact, in a lot of cases, they're using a lot of the same small UAVs. In fact, I don't know if you saw this, but I think it was in September, the Army actually said that they were going to ban the use of the DJI drones. And DJI is a Chinese company. Because there was concern that the Chinese were accessing information through the drones about what the U.S. military was doing with the vehicles.
Yowza. Wow. So always like a bunch of new challenges to talk about when you get into new technology. When we talk about autonomy in drones, Dr. Adams, I mean, how far down that road are we? And I mean, and that is part of what you're talking about with this project, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That is correct. So right now, I would say that technology, the autonomy and testing of autonomy for unmanned aerial systems, and that's primarily what I'm going to talk about here because it's different for ground vehicles, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Is limited by the FAA. So the FAA has put a number of regulations in place with regard to unmanned aerial systems, particularly to try to protect everyone and our commercial manned aircraft. And so that regulation really does not permit what we would call fully autonomous systems, systems that can fly without any human input, and really limits that autonomy. Right now, there's some basic capabilities on the drones that you can buy. For example, the DJI drones that you could buy for your Christmas, things like trying to avoid obstacles automatically. So if you are flying towards, you know, in an area where maybe you're coming up on a building, it should try to avoid the building. There's also return to home. So if it loses radio communications, which it should be in a direct link all the time due to the FAA regulations, it will either land or it will try to fly back to a home point, wherever that was at the time that the vehicle started flying, or it will try to fly back towards where it last had communications. It should do those things, I should say. Doesn't always happen, because if you work with robots, you know that there's always issues, but that is what's supposed to happen. Ultimately, if you look at some of the research that is being done in indoor environments or netted environments, so a netted environment is outdoors. It is a large, think of like a baseball, you know, the nets that they use for throwing baseballs, except think of it covering a football field. So in those kinds of environments, you are able to test out autonomy. Of course, it's very limited because you've got a very limited flight space. So there is testing of these more advanced autonomous capabilities, things like having a complete flight plan that the vehicle is able to execute on its own. You know, there's some people in various areas working on actually putting what we call grippers, if you can think of it as a hand, on UAVs in order to be able to pick things up and manipulate them. You know, so people are trying to test these things, but right now you can't fly that kind of technology in our national airspace.
Aside from any FAA regulations, though, is there sort of a drone code of ethics among scientists or between countries, some guidelines for how drones will and will not be used?
There's been a lot of talk about developing that, and there's various groups attempting to work towards those components. I am not 100% familiar with how much that effort has coalesced. It's not just drones. It's artificial intelligence in general. It's not just unmanned aerial systems. It's robots in general. You know, especially in the military, you could be talking about any type of vehicle that we talk about in research purposes. So, you know, something like an underwater glider that is used for oceanographic purposes of, you know, understanding what's happening with marine life or with the ocean environment, that can be used by the military as well. So the question that you're asking about the ethics is much broader than drones, than the UAS. I'm sorry, unmanned aerial system. There is, I know, various organizations that have started to work on these issues and actually have been working on them for many years. I think it's like any type of, I guess they call them treaties, that you have with regard to military issues, that they are enforced by the people who actually sign them, right? But then you've got other agents who don't necessarily, or countries, if you will, that don't necessarily follow those treaties. And we've seen some of that over the years in other things that have been done, for example, by NATO.
Dr. Julie Adams from Oregon State University, our guest. We're talking about drone swarm technology. Here's a call from Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Are they yet using robo-bees in these swarms?
You mean really small drones?
Yeah, they're called robo-bees. Harvard and DARPA and Monsanto were working on them in combination a couple years ago.
All right, thanks for that. Julie?
Yeah, so for our particular project, no, we are not using the robo-bees. They're too small. And they're actually, I mean, they're an interesting technology. And, in fact, I have a student looking at how something like robo-bees could be used to pollinate different types of crops. And so for that particular project, we really want to focus on how we can help replace the dying populations of honeybees with something that would allow us to continue to improve our crop yields. But that technology is not part of the projects that I am currently working on. The big project that we're working on is using much larger vehicles. So something like the DJI Phantom, which we're not using, the 3DR Solo. So those are vehicles, the 3DR Solo, for example, you can buy for a couple $100 off of Amazon. When it first came out, it was like $2,000. They're larger. They're probably about 18 inches in diameter. But the idea of using something like the RoboBees, for example, to replace bee swarms or to assist bee swarms is a very important goal of some of the research, but it's not currently being used in our projects.
We have about a minute left, Dr. Adams, and I just want to ask about the complicatedness of all this. I mean, we're not talking about just individual drones, but whole bunches of them with things,
right.
With things I imagine like, what drone 33 does when 31 and 32 are lost.
Right. So you asked a moment ago about baselines and, for example, one person to five vehicles. I actually am an expert in human swarm interaction. And basically what we have determined is that it's really not one person to five vehicles or 10 vehicles, that you have to look at how can you influence the swarm overall and how can you monitor the swarm overall. So it's not looking at individuals. And the interesting thing in most of our work is that we are really focused on the biological species of swarms, so fish or birds, for example, and trying to use the localized communication that would go on between the individuals. And so what we're trying to do is ensure that if you lose one vehicle, that it's not disrupting the entire swarm. You're supposed to get a level of robustness from having the larger numbers. And so in biological species, you can lose a large number of the individuals and the swarm is still successful and resilient. And that's what we hope to achieve.
Can't wait to talk to you in a year and see how far things have gone down the road.
It will be interesting. Hopefully we're going to make great inroads. So.
All right. We will see. Dr. Julie Adams is a computer science professor at Oregon State University working out of Collaborative Robotics and Intelligent Systems, also called CORUS. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Take care.